Hello, this is Dr. Daniel Woodhead. I'm pastor of the Pentwater Bible Church and on staff at Schofield Seminary, and we're bringing you an April 2014 edition of The Gathering Storm to talk about a very, very important topic, which is the division of the land of Israel, how God views this, and what he has done for any infractions that we can see thereof. Now, with me today to talk about this important topic is Dr. Tom McCall. Dr. McCall has been one of my seminary professors. He's also a graduate of Talbot and Dallas seminaries, and he's a contributor to my blog, drwoodhead.com, as well as populating his own blog and a website called tommccallministries.com. Dr. McCall, it's a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Woodhead, and it's wonderful to be with you, and I always enjoy our conversations, and particularly interested in the topic that we're going to discuss today about Israel.
Dr. McCall, I would like to read a set of verses, three verses in particular, from the third chapter of the book of Joel. And then I want to talk just for a few moments about who owns this land. Ownership of all property is an important concept, and but in particular, this one little piece of real estate on the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea has had significant issues throughout human history. Let me read the first three verses from chapter 3 of the book of Joel. The prophet says, from God, he says, for behold, in those days and in that time, when I shall bring back the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will execute judgment upon them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and they have parted my land, and have cast lots for my people, and have given a boy for a harlot, and sold a girl for wine, that they may drink. Now, clearly he's talking about the campaign of Armageddon and the events during the tribulation that the Antichrist is going to be doing. But, you know, since the Exodus, when God gave the law, he made it very, very clear what his position was on this property. And I'm reminded of Leviticus 25:23, where God says, and the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, for ye are strangers and sojourners with me. Now, this particular verse is not discussing the division of the land, but is discussing the ownership. And ownership gives privilege. It gives the individual who owns something the right to do with it as he pleases. And God has given this land to the nation Israel. Can you expound a bit on us of when this actually occurred and how it was taking place?
Well, it's an interesting thing that Joel prophesying so many hundreds of years ago is talking about events that are beginning to shape up right now. And the harbinger of it is that the nation is returning to the land, is being brought back from the nations into the land. And it's a long process. It's taken about 200 years of what we see today. And it's only moving forward toward the ultimate fulfillment of the restoration of the nation Israel to the Lord as well as to the land. And it is definitely true. This is God's land. He says it's his land. I remember when Billy Graham came out years ago with his film about the new state of Israel, and the title of his movie on the thing was His Land, and it is God's land. And he has given a grant of the land to his people Israel, and they are the human owners of the land. and nobody else. It is the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they have the ownership, but they don't always have the possession of the land. There have been interruptions to the possession of the land in the 70-year Babylonian captivity, and now the almost 2,000-year exile of the people. It's called the Galut in the Hebrew, and diaspora, and it's the dispersion of the people. So they haven't always had possession of the land, but they have always had the ownership, the human ownership of the land. Now when God gave the land to the people and they began to occupy it at the time of Joshua, the land was divided up by God into the tribal areas, and each tribe had a designated area and had meets and bounds as to where they would settle. So that was the division of the land, but it was by God, and he has the right to divide the land as he sees fit. And, of course, there was another division of the land at the time of the death of Solomon, and the ten tribes split off from Judah and Benjamin and sort of their own sub-nation, which they called Israel. So there was Israel and Judah. So that was a division, but that was in the purview and will of the Lord. He prophesied that that would happen at the time of the death of Solomon. So there have been divisions. God ordained divisions, and that's one thing. But what he's talking about in Joel is how the Gentiles have come in and tried to divide and split up the land and have for millennia.
Well, that's an important point there, that he did cause some divisions, but since he's the owner, he can do this, and he does this for specific reasons, to give the tribes their allotment, like you said in Joshua, and also Numbers 32, and to cause a division in the land because of the sins in the United Monarchy, because this happened, if I recall correctly, after Solomon had died. Jeroboam went to the north and took those ten tribes, and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, took the two tribes in the south. But it's a question I wanted to ask you now, and in Scripture there is a finite boundary to the land, and when was that established?
Well, it goes back to the Abrahamic covenant, when God promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their descendants, the land from the river of Egypt to the Euphrates. And that was approximately occupied during the time of Solomon, but it never has been fully occupied, and that seems to await the return of Christ to the earth, when he will fully grant all of the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So it goes back to that, and then it's been reaffirmed over and over again throughout the Scriptures, including in the prophecy of Joel here, that we see that the Lord is very concerned about the treatment of the land in connection with the nation of Israel.
That's really an important point. What I find so interesting about this is that God has given, in this land grant to Israel, specific boundaries, and they haven't realized those boundaries yet, but that shape and division has changed many times over human history, usually to the detriment of those that are trying to do that to the Jews and to God's property. Let's take a look at some historical instances where the Gentiles have tried to divide the land. Now, in our previous discussions, you had mentioned some extremely interesting events that happened around the time that the Romans under Titus Vespasian destroyed the temple in 70 A.D. Can you share those with us?
Yes, that was a seminal event in the history of Israel when Rome came in, and according to prophecy, even our Lord's prophecy, destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed the temple and began to scatter the Jewish people all over the Roman Empire and put them into bondage, and all kinds of things happened. That was in 70 A.D. In 73, you had the destruction of the last stronghold in Israel, which was Masada, in the very challenging story written by Josephus about that, and that's all we know about it, and it's an amazing story. But at any rate, Jerusalem was crushed, and Israel was destroyed, and Rome even minted a coin about this and had on it Judea Capta, which means Judea captured, destroyed, and that was a big thing in the eyes of the Roman emperors and the Roman people. Well, it's believed by many people that some of the great structures in Rome came about as a result of the capture of Jerusalem, that the Colosseum, one of the most magnificent structures in Rome, was built and financed by the gold that had been captured by and confiscated by Rome with the burning of the temple. There's enormous quantities of gold that was captured at that time. And so all of this was going on in the 60s, and in the 70s, and in 79, one of the most catastrophic events in Roman history occurred, and that was the eruption of Mount Vesuvius and the destruction of two of the main cities in Italy, Pompeii and Herculaneum. They were totally destroyed by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Was that just coincidence? Or is it likely that that was a judgment of God upon the Roman Empire for the destruction of Israel and Jerusalem?
Well, I would certainly subscribe to the issue that this was a judgment by God. And to affirm that and add some more information to that, we could take a look at the Gibbon's account of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. He starts the decline and fall in the late 70s, early 80s AD. And that's where he starts with Germans coming down like Commodus and becoming the emperor. And the destruction of the Roman Empire happened just about that time. So we can, he chronicalized it, and he just watched it get worse and worse and worse and worse. You can't violate the Abrahamic covenant, where God says in chapter 12 of Genesis that those that bless Israel will get blessed, and those that curse Israel are going to be cursed. You know, one of the...
adequately in your dissertation, historically, what has happened to those nations that have cursed Israel?
Oh, my goodness, isn't that true? And one piece of information that I really enjoyed finding was Benjamin Disraeli. He became a Christian, but he was of Jewish lineage, and his father was Jewish. He became the only Jewish prime minister of England in the late 1800s, and he made the statement in Parliament that we better pay attention to the Jews, he said, because no nation that harmed them has ever gone unscathed. And he used Spain as an example. You know, Spain had a vast empire until the Inquisitions, and they started to lose it all. So it is a fact. It is true. And what we're seeing here is some interesting events that have happened to substantiate that. The Romans eventually lost everything that they had. Who knows about the Romans today? It's historical. You know, you can look over at Italy and you can see a country, but it's not Rome anymore. Rome is just a city within the country of Italy.
The Roman Empire is no more, and Latin is a dead language. Oh. Israel is alive again as a nation, and Hebrew is the national language. It's quite a contrast.
You know, it's interesting to read what the secular linguists have to say about the emergence of Hebrew, re-emergence, should I say, as a lingua franca, the spoken language of the day for commerce and general activities. They try and dance around that topic, but they can't deny it's the only language that ever came back in all of human history. There's been a lot of dead languages, but this is the only one that ever came back. You know, the after the Romans were in the process of declining, we enter into a period of the Islamic caliphates that controlled Jerusalem from the late 600s, early 700s on. Now, those caliphates, for by and large, did not divide up Jerusalem. They conquered it, but there wasn't too many people there after the Bar Kokhba rebellion of 135 AD, so it wasn't an area of importance to them. I believe we get into the last caliphate there, the Ottoman Turkish Empire, that, if I'm correct from your teaching, it ran from approximately 1500 to 1900, and they left the land alone for the most part and just considered it to be a southern appendage to Syria until the early 1900s, when they divided the land just before the First World War. Can you tell us what happened after that?
That's right, and just to back up just a little bit, the whole period of the caliphate of the Ottoman Empire, you had the land of Israel essentially in disarray and in abandonment, and after the Crusades, the Arabs, including the Muslim rule of the caliphate of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, everything was abandoned. The whatever water was there was made into swamps that had were infested with malaria. The trees had been denuded, what trees there were, and it was a wasteland. So when our own author, Mark Twain, went over there in the 1860s following the war between the states. He observed the condition of the Holy Land, and he traveled all up and down it, and he said, "I can't understand why this would be considered the promised land. It is so desolate and so disease-ridden and so poverty-stricken." And he just couldn't understand why it was considered the promised land. Well, of course, since the Jewish people have come back, well, it's become a much different area, and is much, 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 much better. It's a modern state. But at any rate, when you get to the World War One, as you asked, then the Ottoman Empire was allied with Germany and was defeated along with Germany in World War One. And then you had the Treaty of Versailles right after World War One, which was presaged by an event that was very important, called the Balfour Declaration, and there's an interesting story about that. There were two men in England, Lord Balfour and Chaim Weizmann. And Weizmann was a chemist from Germany, and now he lived in Britain. But he was very instrumental in inventing certain munitions, rather technical, that had to do with winning World War One, and broke the stalemate between the Allies and the German forces. And Britain wanted to show its appreciation for this and ask Weizmann, what can we do for you? And he and Balfour were good friends. Balfour had been the prime minister. Now he was the foreign minister of Britain. And he and Weizmann put together what has been called the Balfour Declaration, which was a declaration by Britain at the tail end of the World War One, whereby Britain, His Majesty's government, looked with favor upon the return of the Jewish people back to their homeland. That was a great instrument. But it didn't have any teeth in it because Britain didn't have control over the land. But shortly after that, you had the Treaty of Versailles, which split up the Europe as to how it would be organized after, following World War One. And then a year later, in 1920, thereabouts, there was the Treaty of San Remo in Italy, which was composed of the four countries that fought against the Ottoman Empire. The United States was not one of them. We were restrained to just Europe. But Britain, France, Italy, and Japan, of all nations, were fighting against the Ottoman Empire. And they split up the Middle East. And in the San Remo Treaty, France got Syria and Lebanon. England got what was called Palestine, which was a anti-Israel term, goes back to Emperor Hadrian at the time of the Bar Kokhba rebellion during Roman times. At any rate, it was called Palestine, and Britain got control of it. And then Italy got control of parts of North Africa. That was the San Remo Agreement, and then that was later ratified in Versailles, and it was made a part of the whole settlement of World War One. So, essentially, they were splitting up, they were dividing up the land of Palestine, and then you had Britain in control and had the British mandate, and much follows after that.
Interesting. Now, I think one of the other key factors that you just brought out there about Chaim Weizmann is he was, along with Theodor Herzl, implementing a movement back to the land Israel that we call the Zionist movement now. And the conclusion of World War One, as you said, with Great Britain taking control of that area, really promoted the Zionist movement. And it made things in Israel really start to move forward, getting them closer to being a country. Now,
well, the gun is a trickle of Jewish people moving back to the land by the hundreds and by the thousands, really opened up into a stream of 100,000 going back to the land and more, with the movement of the Zionist organization and with the World War One treaties and with the Balfour Declaration. A lot of Jewish people now were taking hold of the Zionist idea and returning back to the land.
Related to our topic, the division of the land, this event at that treaty caused Great Britain to under something called the British Mandate. And that mandate, if I understand my dates correctly, was from approximately 1920 to 1946, just before the nation of Israel was declared an independent sovereign nation. Now, what happened during that mandate to cause Great Britain to begin to fail and to change their attitude towards the Jews? Because if I understand this more modern history correctly, they were dividing up the land for political reasons too, weren't they?
They were. Their mandate included what was called Palestine, and that included what we know as Israel today and the Kingdom of Jordan, all of that territory up to Saudi Arabia. And as a matter of fact, Jill was one of the managers of the Mandate of Palestine. Well, during that time, there was there were two factions in Great Britain. One was the Lord Balfour group that was pro-Israel and pro the Jewish people returning to the land. The other group was the Lawrence of Arabia group, who had a great mystique for the British people. And he had, in World War One, he had led the Arab forces to capture Damascus, Syria, and the Levant there. And he became sort of a hero figure in the British Empire. So there was a pro-Arab section, and there was a pro-Jewish section within Israel, and it created quite a certain amount of turmoil because Britain was beginning to speak out of both sides of its mouth, making promises to the Arabs and making promises to the Jews, and it got to be very confusing as time went on, and as the Second World War rolled around.
My goodness. You know, it's interesting that Great Britain, through some of these efforts that you're describing here with a division between some, some help to the Arabs and some help to the Jews, I think...
Yeah, and that was good in splitting up the land, and they gave what is Jordan now to the Arabs, and they gave what is... mostly Israel today to the Jews. That's how they split up the land in the 20s and 30s.
Well, what I find interesting about this is Britain was an enormous help to bringing the Jews back and ending the Ottoman Turkish Empire, supporting Zionism. They had a great relationship with Israel. And when I was at the Hebrew University, I could see the graveyards on the university campus honoring the British warriors. I can see Christian churches, Presbyterian churches built. I stayed in one. And, you can see that there was a great relationship. Well, that relationship seemed to have fallen apart. And Great Britain, about the time that they started turning away from Israel and supporting the Arabs, they started to lose some of what they had. After the Second World War, they went through a tremendous amount of social change, and they went bankrupt. The pro-Israeli Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, was voted out of office. They voted in a new labor government that unionized and or supported the unions, and nationalized a lot of businesses that caused those businesses to have to charge more money for the new way of doing business. And I think the most interesting thing is that they lost their empire. They lost India. They lost all of their commonwealth in it. And as you've said, it used to be said that the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, they divide up the land. They change it, and look what happens to them.
It's important to see what a change there was in Britain, because right alongside the development of the Zionist movement among the Jews, there was a Zionist among the Christians in Britain mainly, also some in Europe, and then also many in America, a pro-Zionist attitude among Christians who believed the Bible and believed that there would be a restoration of the Jewish people back to the land, and so they were very sympathetic to the Jewish Zionist movement. But then as we moved from during the time of the mandate from a relatively pro-Israel stance to almost an anti-Israel stance at the time of World War II, then you had after World War II a realization of what the Jews had gone through in Europe with the Holocaust, and that millions and millions of Jews had been killed and put in concentration camps and all the rest during the Nazi regime. It began to dawn on people that the Jews had suffered greatly, and so there was a counter movement to get the Jews back into the land. But then there was the story of the Exodus, the ship that was loaded with Jewish refugees from Europe trying to get into Israel, and the British would not allow these Jewish refugees into the land there at Haifa, and they were turned away, and they were actually brought into Cyprus, which was also controlled by the British at that point, and these poor refugees were put back into concentration camps. What a horrible development. And this was creating national attention and international attention. But by and large, Europe was turning against the Jewish state to a certain extent, and they decided they were just going to wash their hands of the whole thing. In 1947, they pulled out of Palestine, thinking that it wasn't even a state then. The people of Israel would disappear. They would not be sustainable. What a great transformation there was when the British pulled out. The Jews declared independence. They were recognized by the United States and some other countries. The Arab peoples, the 22 nations around Israel and the immediate neighbors, declared war on the nascent state of Israel, and then Israel was victorious. Surprise, surprise. Who could imagine such a thing? And the state of Israel was born. But, like you say, Britain had pulled out. Britain had turned against Israel to a certain extent, to a large extent. And their empire began to decline precipitously, and for years lost one after another, until now the British Empire, there is a Commonwealth, but the British Empire is no more.
Well, yeah, the Commonwealth is just minuscule today. They just have 14 small satellites, and even those are independent. They're not tied economically to Britain. They're tied in some sort of a treaty, if you will, of help each other sort of thing. But Great Britain lost it all. Now, you brought out that War of Independence in 1948. There have been several wars that had a similar nature, fighting the Arabs. And at one point in time, in one war, the Israelis were able to take the Sinai and include that into their real estate, which was God-given. We see that in the Abrahamic covenant. But
it was a very important thing when they, and I was in the Six-Day War in 1967, and they were able to capture the whole Sinai Peninsula. which was very historic for Israel because it did include Mount Sinai, the place of the giving of the law, and so many of those things. But also economically, it had those gas wells and oil wells, and this made Israel more or less energy independent for many years, some 20 years.
But then there was an event. There was an event when they made a deal. I think it was Begin, the Prime Minister of Israel, and Sadat, the President of Egypt. They made a deal to give the Sinai back to Egypt. My goodness. So here's more division of the land. What happens then?
Well, you had America was also involved in that. I think that was during who was the president at that time? At any rate, our president was involved in that considerably, and they made that agreement. But then Sadat, who was one of the architects of that, was assassinated. And what had he done? He had divided the land of Israel. This was a punishment, it would seem, a retribution for doing that. Of course, it was Muslim fanatics who assassinated him. But nevertheless, he was brought down, in part, I think, because he had divided Israel.
Wow. You know, it's interesting is when you get into the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush and the plan to divide Israel that he orchestrated, soon thereafter he decided to do this. There was what the meteorologists call the perfect storm, which was a confluence of three different massive storm fronts that focused on his home in Kennebunkport, Maine. Now, is this chance? Is this happenstance? You know, the rabbis would say that that's not a kosher term. And I think you can look at these events and you can see a tie here because of the historical precedent of the Abrahamic covenant and God doesn't want his land divided, and these things that happen to divide the land are going to suffer. They are going to suffer. There's another one that I'd like to bring out, and these are from a really interesting book called Eye to Eye by I think it was Bill Koenig, and I may not have his first name correct, but he has highlighted a lot of these events, and we're indebted to him for bringing this stuff up for us. There was a time when there were some peace talks, if you will, that George Bush II, he had come, or actually the first, and Rabin, and the same day that they initiated these peace talks here on August the 24th of 1992, you get a hurricane that hits the south coast of Florida. Now, is that happenstance? Could be.
Yes, all these peace talks and everything that the world has wanted to impose on Israel have been an effort to divide the land.
Absolutely. And then we get into President Clinton's administration, and he agrees to a peace process to divide the land. And shortly thereafter, that was February the 18th to the 25th of 93. Well, February the 26th, first World Trade Center bombing.
Yeah.
You know, you look at these events and you can't say with certainty that they're just happenstance. I mean, just things happen randomly when the scriptures declare that God controls everything. So
yeah, that's right. And all these efforts for peace involve a division of the land. And giving the Arabs a certain amount of land and then the Jews a certain amount of land, that's dividing the land. And perhaps we ought to say here that God does have a promised land for the Arabs. After all, they are descendants of Abraham through Ishmael, many of them are. And God does promise land to Ishmael and his descendants. But that land was to the east. Ishmael was sent to the east. And that included the Arabs like Saudi Arabia and Edom and places like that. Well, God gave them that land. That is their promised land. And we have nothing against the Arabs per se. They need the gospel, and many of them are coming to Christ even in these days, and we're grateful for that. But the land from the Mediterranean to the Jordan and beyond into the mountains of Gilead and all of that are certainly part of the land that the Lord has promised to Israel and not to anybody else. So we don't have any business of trying to split up that land to somebody else. It may be with purposes and ideas of peace and so forth, but it is contrary to the Lord's will and purpose, and we can only expect displeasure from God, probably in the form of some kind of events like hurricanes and all those things to follow our decisions to do that.
And you know, it's interesting is that the insurance company calls those things acts of God. we can't say that man created that hurricane. No, these are acts of God, which is exactly what we're talking about here. I wanted to bring out another issue here that pertains to this as well, and that was what we call the Oslo Peace Accords, that in 93 these things were going on, and of course the United States was active in that, and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin agreed to give property that the Lord belongs, to which it belongs to the Lord, to Yasser Arafat and the PLO. Well, what happened to Yitzhak Rabin as a result of doing that?
He was the Prime Minister of Israel, and he entered into this accord, and he was assassinated. Yes, and these things have happened, and they seem to follow immediately or shortly thereafter some kind of agreement to divide the land. And we must observe that. We must understand that there's a connection here, and the Lord does not want us to be involved in splitting up the land.
Amen. On September the 28th of 1995, Israel and the PLO signed an interim agreement to divide the land, and that was followed by Hurricane Opal on the Florida coast, the Gulf of New Mexico. Now, you get these things happening, just as you said, because of the division of the land. I want to direct your attention to something even more recent than those things that we're talking about here, and that is during the presidency of George Bush II, and what I find so fascinating here, that he directed the CIA director, George Tenet, at the time to get a ceasefire agreement in place between the parties in Israel that were having some conflict and move towards dividing the land. Well, one thing happens is a tropical storm, Allison, just pummeled Houston and George Bush's home in Crawford, Texas. And then we all know what happened after that. September the 1st, 2001, the World Trade Center were taken down, and so was a airplane by the Arab Muslims used to fly into the Pentagon. My goodness. Can you...
This is the worst attack upon American soil that we've ever experienced from a foreign source. And it was a tremendous thing. The Muslims were dancing in the streets approving all of that. And this was a terrible thing to happen to us. And it brought us into war with Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, that's an interesting observation, Dr. McCall, because those wars are still going on 13 years later. 13 years later, we still have those wars taking place. And I wanted to bring out another one, and that is Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who is a great military man and a fine general, fine prime minister, until he decided that he was going to give up the Gaza Strip and, surprisingly, the what they call now the West Bank, which you and I would call Judea and Samaria. Well, what happened after he did that?
Well, like you say, he was a hero. He was a hero of the Israeli people. In the previous wars that had been fought, his military strategy and tactics were amazing and were copied by military institutions around the world. But then, and he was a great supporter of settlements that were on the so-called West Bank, that is where Judea and Samaria are located, where thousands and thousands of Jewish people set up suburbs, beautiful homes and areas that were connected to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv by corridors protected by the Israeli officers and army. At any rate, he was a supporter of that, and then just all of a sudden, he began to take the other side and say, "Well, let's give up Gaza. It's not so important to us, and let's deed that over to the Arabs, to the Muslim people who lived in Gaza." Of course, it meant the disruption of hundreds, perhaps thousands of Jews who lived in the Gaza area, and they were summarily pulled out of their homes and neighborhoods and everything and resettled, and Gaza was given over to the Arabs with the hope that they would have elections, that they would have a peaceful regime installed, there would be commerce and good relations with Gaza.
My goodness, it's just incredible to see a man like him turn away from his love for Israel, the sovereignty of Israel, that land, give it away, and he goes into that vegetative state for a number of years. He just passed away this past year.
Yes, he had a stroke right after that. Was in a coma, a vegetative state, for 8 years, and then died recently. It was a tragic thing.
My goodness.
And then what happened to Israel as a result of that? They had elections in Gaza, but who was elected? It was a Hamas, a radical Islamic terrorist regime. They began sending people into Israel for car bombings and bus bombings and all of that, and they began to lob missiles into southern Israel.
Wow.
And have done that for years.
That's so incredible.
That's the result of splitting up the land. And now they want to do it again with the West Bank. The definition of insanity. Doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different result.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. Well, Dr. McCall, with the 10 minutes that we have left on our interview this morning, I'd like to focus in on the future, if you will, and back to our passage in Joel that we looked at about the judgment in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And I want to focus in on what that says, because of the scattering of the Jews in the middle of the Great Tribulation and the parting of the land during the campaign of Armageddon and the selling of the Jews into slavery. One of the major sins here in this campaign of Armageddon is the parting of the land of Israel. And we know, and we've seen in our discussion, that God does not want that. It's his sovereign real estate. He's given it to the Jewish folks as in a leasehold arrangement, and he does not want this to happen. However, during the campaign of Armageddon, as Daniel 11:39 even says, that he, that's the Antichrist, shall deal with the strongest fortresses by the help of a foreign god, and that's Satan. Whosoever acknowledgeth him, he will increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for a price. Well, we know that this is yet future to us, but the Lord Jesus talked about this, and I believe he called this the judgment of the valley, or in the valley of Jehoshaphat, of the sheep and the goats. Could you close us up here for the next 10 minutes or so talking about that?
Yes, well, there are at least two prophetic wars leading up to the second coming of Christ. One is the Gog and Magog war, describing Ezekiel 38 and 39, and the purpose of that attack against Israel is to capture Israel, to take spoil from Israel, and in essence to divide the land up and capture it and so forth. But that's going to be destroyed by the Lord, who will rain down fire from heaven and will destroy the army, and the Gog and Magog will fall on the mountains of Israel and in the valleys of Israel and be devoured by vultures and so forth. So that's one attempt to divide the land, to conquer the land that will be foiled by the Lord. And then, as you mentioned, the final war before the Lord returns is Armageddon, where all the nations of the earth come against Israel, and their motive is to destroy the land, to capture the land, to take the land, and to do their will in the land and with the people of Israel. And in the midst of all that, of course, as described in the book of Revelation, you have the rise of the Antichrist, who wants to take over the temple. And he sits in the temple and claims to be God, and demands the worship of the people. And from then on, he's at a tremendous war against Israel that culminates in the War of Armageddon. And one reason why the Antichrist and Satan want to destroy Israel is to prevent the second coming of Christ. Because Jesus said to Israel, "You will not see me henceforth until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Baruch, Abba, Hashem, Adonai. There is every motive for Satan wanting to try to destroy Israel, to divide it up, to conquer the land and everything else. But he's not going to be successful. The Lord is going to intervene again, and he will destroy the armies of the Antichrist in Armageddon, and then go about to establish his kingdom. In the process of this, Israel is going to be saved. All Israel is going to be saved. That is, the remaining nation of Israel who survives the tribulation and the great tribulation and the time of Jacob's trouble, those Jewish people that survive to the end of the tribulation era, one third of the nation, Jeremiah tells us, will receive the Lord and will be born in a day, and they shall look upon him whom they have pierced, Zechariah said, and the whole nation will be saved. Israel will become the first 100% Christian nation. And what is their what is the result of that, in addition to eternal life and everything? They will enter as mortals into the Messianic kingdom and will be the head of the nations as Christ rules as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, then the question is, what Gentiles will be permitted to enter in to the Messianic kingdom along with saved Israel? Well, you have the judgment of the sheep and the goats. The sheep are the righteous Gentiles, and they're righteous like everybody else who is righteous became righteous because they believed in the Lord Jesus Christ. And they believed like Abraham believed, and it was counted to them for righteousness. But as the Lord tells them, you have demonstrated your righteousness by doing acts of benevolence to the least of these, his brethren, the Lord's brethren, the Jewish people, during the horrible time of the tribulation. And he said, "And as much as you did it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me." And they will be allowed to go in as mortals into the Messianic kingdom. The goat Gentiles, on the other hand, were those that demonstrated their unbelief by taking the mark of the beast, by following the Antichrist, by rejecting the gospel, and they will be cast into the lake of fire. They will be cast into and the goats also have been involved in dividing the land and attacking Israel and persecuting the Jewish people. So that's the ultimate judgment on those who have divided the land and been inimical to the interests of the nation Israel.
You know, it's interesting you point that out about the two divisions of the Gentiles there, the sheep and the goats. I like to look at the Nazi Holocaust and the whole 12-year reign of Adolf Hitler as a microcosm of what's going to happen under the reign of the Antichrist, the Jews call Armillus, when he comes. And you can look at folks that were sympathetic towards the Jewish people and hid them, like Corrie Ten Boom and her family, where
That's
she
right.
characterizes a lot of this in her book called A Hiding Place, or The Hiding Place, and others have written about this, like The Diary of Anne Frank and so on. So we know that there were a lot of people that helped them, and they would be the sheep Gentiles. And then we know that there are a lot of people that align themselves with the policies of the Nazis and Adolf Hitler and sought out to harm the Jews. Well, then they would be viewed as in that venue as goat Gentiles. So it's just fascinating to see that God has given us these indications, these types, if you will, or models of behavior for us to see what's going to happen in the future. What's going to happen?
And by the way, in Israel, Corrie Ten Boom and others are called righteous Gentiles, and they're given a place of honor in Israel today.
That
is a little bit what's going to happen with the millennial kingdom.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Dr. McCall, I have to thank you very, very much for agreeing to help us understand this topic of the division of the land and giving us your profound insight here on the nation Israel. And our audience, we're going to close out this issue of The Gathering Storm, and we would ask you to look at Schofield Prophecy Studies, and please pass this on or ask others if they would like to subscribe to The Gathering Storm. We have noted theologians and Bible teachers that regularly come into our studios and via telephone to present important Bible topics for you that are relevant today. God bless you, and we look forward to being with you in our next session.